Well, then welcome you all to our first talk in our series of Bible talks on legal philosophy and Staatswissenschaft. We plan to have three talks this semester. The first one is tonight. Then there's going to be a second talk by Jaap Hage on the 10th of December at the same time, same hour. And the third talk is going to be announced. Those who want to be informed about the talks, we have a list, a mailing list, and you're very much invited to send a mail to my secretary, and we will put you on the list, and then you will get the announcement, but also additional materials, like Claudio, for example, was so nice to send us his paper in advance. So if you're on the list, you will receive the paper in advance. You will get short summaries and all that is around it. So we are thinking even about setting up a Facebook page. We have to see about that. But until then, we work with the more traditional means of mailing lists. And so whoever is interested is just invited to send us a mail who isn't yet on the list. Today, I'm happy to introduce to you our first speaker, Claudio Michelon. Claudio Michelon got his law degree and his Master of Philosophy from the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul in Porto Alegre in Brazil. And from there, he moved to the University of Edinburgh, where he obtained his doctorate. Then he went back to Brazil, again, to his alma mater, and he worked there as an assistant professor from 2001 to 2006, while at the same time practicing law. So when he talks about analogy in law and private law, he knows actually what he's talking about because he has actually practiced law. And then he decided to join academia again and went back to in 2007 to the Law School of Edinburgh, where he presently holds a chair for philosophy of law. He's also the member of the Edinburgh Legal Theory Group, which organizes a yearly legal theory festival. Everything in Edinburgh has to be a festival, I think. So we even have a legal theory festival now, and it's in Edinburgh. It's a very nice event, and we can only thank the group for organizing it each year. He teaches mainly jurisprudence and private law theory, and his fields of interest also nicely match his course program, because his main interest is in legal reasoning and decision-making and private law theory. And he has authored three books in these fields, one in Portuguese on the theory of unjustified enrichment. Some of you will still be confronted with all these issues. It's always a problem in any legal order, so to have a good theory of it would be really nice. Another book, also in Portuguese, picked up on the remarkable fact that there are very different forms of positivism, which agree that law has to be a social fact, but who picked up on the curious fact that they disagree so much on what that fact should be, actually. So it's a book on Art Kelsen and the Scandinavian realists, among others. And then he has written a book in English, the title Being Apart from Reasons, The Role of Reasons in Public and Private Moral Decision-Making. The book argues against a strong tendency in those people who are engaged in the theory of reasoning, who think that somehow we can compartmentalize different forms of reason and isolate one from others. And the book picks on authors like Rawls and Raz and Waldron. In the case of Rawls, for example, the idea that there are reasons connected to rights which trump reasons connected to goods or can be isolated for them, or in the case of Raz, that there are secondary reasons that can somehow be isolated from primary reasons, or in the case of Waldron, that there are reasons of procedure that can somehow be isolated from reasons of substance. And the thesis of the book is, in the end, that at least public agents must reason always as comprehensively as possible. Besides his books, he has written numerous articles, both on legal theory and private law theory, one discussing the public character of private law, as if public lawyers wouldn't have known this all along. But today he's going to present a draft of an article that he's about to release on a topic that is of interest at least for public and private lawyers alike, maybe not so much for penal lawyers, and which is specifically on the structure of arguments by analogy in law, which are valid for public and private lawyers, but maybe not so much for the penal ones. But we are very much looking forward to your talk, and the floor is yours.
Many thanks. Many thanks. First of all, let me just thank Professor Plosher and the Law School, the Law Faculty, for the invitation. One of the perks of academia is that you can command an audience to stay in front of you and hear your ideas about something that's relatively idiosyncratic and then originally only really interested you. And you can command those people to be there, to listen to you, and to give you feedback. So that's great. And I'd like also to thank all of you for coming today. So, without further ado, let me tell you what the plan is. I wrote this article with Luis Duarte Lameda. It's a jointly authored paper, because we're teaching a course on precedent and analogy and legal reasoning. And all the accounts we read about the structure of analogy seem to be off the mark. There seems to be something wrong with them. We couldn't at the beginning put our fingers exactly on what was wrong, and it took us 1 year to identify precisely what we thought was wrong with the accounts we had. As soon as we identified that, we managed to then proceed to provide our own account of what the structure of argumentative analogy is. Now, a couple of caveats here. First, it's about the structure of arguments of analogy. So it's not about the whole thing. There are bits and pieces that might be typical of analogies as well, or very common analogies. Important for the argument to run that I'm not going to be dealing with, it's really about the structure that should be shared by everyone using an analogy, whether or not they know it. We think analogy is a distinct form of argument, like syllogism or modus ponens. It's a distinct sort of argument. Now, that's not necessarily a view shared by many. So there are some people like Scott Brewer and others who seem to think that there's nothing distinctive about analogy. Analogy is really a combination of a number of different arguments that come together in different ways. We think that there is a structure. For many months, we didn't think there was a structure. And then suddenly we thought that there was a structure. And this is our account. This is what we're trying to put forward as a structure of arguments by analogy. The paper has two parts. Very clearly, one of them is the diagnosis of what went wrong with previous attempts to account for the structure of analogy. What's really the digital print of analogy. From that critique, we're trying to extract one thing, basically, which is what's the burdens that they failed to meet? And then, hence, what burdens do we have to meet if our arguments would be successful? And there are at least two burdens that we identify in the first part. So that's what's going to be happening in the next 15 to 20 minutes. I'm going to try to explain to you how the others fail. And in identifying why the others fail, we're going to have a clear account of what needs to be met, with burdens which burdens need to be met by an account of analogy, of the structure of the argument of analogy. Second part of the paper is our account. So we think now that we have the burdens in place, I'm going to try to run by you the actual structure we think that's present in all analogies, legal analogies, all legal analogies. You're going to see, for those of you who read the paper, we focus on common law reasoning just because we are writing in Edinburgh. And that's the basic way in which you engage with precedent and analogy. But we think that this account, mutatis mutandis, could be accommodated for any sort of legal analogy across the spectrum of legal systems. Right, and that's the second part of the talk today. The last 20 minutes are going to be about unpacking the scheme. Now, for those of you who haven't read the paper, I have some handouts. The handouts are only about the second part of the talk. So, just but only about the second part of the talk. So so you can just happily put it aside for the first 20 minutes, and then we're going to go back to that. The last page tells the spoils the story, because that's the actual scheme I'm going to try to defend here. I just thought it would be handy to have it in front of you when we talk about it. Very well. How do we go about showing that others went wrong? The way we decided to do it is to take what we think is the most promising account so far for ours, where we solved the problem. The most promising account so far, which is Golden's, for two reasons. One, because it's very well known and it's very successful. Many people explain analogy. Nowadays, we reviewed most of the literature, if not all the literature available, in many languages. And mostly everyone either directly used Golding or, and that's important, used schemes that are effectively tantamount to Golding's scheme. So even if they didn't use Golding or didn't read Golding, Golding's scheme seems to be tracking something that is not simply particular to him. It seems to be not only because it was very successful and many people adopted it, but even people who probably never heard of him in, say, we read texts on Jewish law written before Golding wrote his text, that they seem to be tracking the same idea. Right? So what we decided to do is to critique Golding. If you look at the paper, I don't know if you have the paper, but the scheme is very simple. It's in page 2 of the paper I sent you. It's a 5-premise scheme. Yeah. You identify you have a problem, which is how to solve a particular decision-making problem. Yeah. So you have a source case, a target case. So the target case is what you want to solve, the problem you want to solve. The source case is the case that seems to be the one you're relying on to try to solve the problem. So when you have an analogy, you always have something that is the problem and something that is the original case you're trying to analogize with your problem to see if you can find a solution. So you have a source case, you have a target case, that's what's tracked in the premises 1 and 2. You notice that both the target and the source, they share some characteristics, they share some features. And then you say, well, they share features F and G. So the source has F and G, the target has F and G. Well, the source also has feature H, so perhaps you can have good reason to think that the target also has feature H. Notice, this kind of argument clearly is not deductive, yeah? It's not necessarily the case that they're going to share the case, but it gives you a reason to believe that that might be the case. That's the structure that Golding thinks is relevant. Now, if you do just that, it looks like your argument really is not even persuasive. If you only have the first 3 premises and try to jump to the conclusion, there's no reason to believe that just because 2 people share 2 features, they won't share anything else. Yeah? Or 2 chairs share 2 features, the color and the fact that they have arms, that everything else that they share would be comparable. It's very difficult to make that inference. So you need premise number 4 here in the scheme. Yeah? You need something like this. The features they share, say features F and G, they are relevant for the possession of the feature that you want to analogize. That has to be H relevant. Right? I'm going to give you examples about that, but as we age relevant. And from all those, you can conclude that unless there are countervailing considerations, says Golding, that the feature H should be shared as well between cases, source and target. That seems to be the general structure of analogies, not only in law, but also descriptive analogies. In fact, Golding starts by giving you an example which is based on not on law, but on inferences you can make about car salesmen. We run through the example in the paper, but let me give you remind you of that. So you have a particular salesman or a particular person is applying for a job, you have to decide, as a salesman, a car salesman, you have to decide whether or not to give that person the job. Now, you have two other car salesmen that worked for you before. And you know a few things about them. And you know a few things about your applicant. You know that all of them graduated from the same university. You know that all of them graduated in physical education. And you know that they have very good references from their coach. Right? So what you might be tempted to think is something like this. The source case, in the case of the salesman that we know, the source cases might be more than one, they have features F and G and H, F and G, same university, etc. Target case has those features. We know that the first ones, the source cases, were excellent salesmen. They're brilliant salesmen. Now, if you think that possessing those features, F and G, being graduate from University X and being in physical education and being having good references, if you think that that's relevant to being a car salesman, you'd be inclined to think that even if you don't know whether this particular person in front of you, the applicant, is a good car salesman, well, you have good reasons to believe that he's going to be as well. Because the other ones were, they had the same features, so you have good reasons. Now, again, notice that Golding is cleverly watering down the conclusion, yeah? It says, unless there are contravening considerations, because of course, it might be that you know the person is a serial killer, and you know other, you have more information about your target that's going to offset the comparison. So there might be countervailing considerations, but what it gives to you in this particular case is a reason to believe, not even a reason for action for hiring him, but at least a reason to believe that he's going to be a good car salesman, yeah? Now, it's not a conclusive reason, it's probably at most a potential reason, but it's a reason nevertheless. That's what Golding wants us to believe. Right. So, how does that work in the legal context? Let me give you the example that everyone who writes in English about analogy, well, not everyone, but 90% of the people writing in English about analogy use. It's the Adams case. And if you want to take a look of how that looks like, is in page 7 of the paper. So in the Adams case, what you have is this. Steamboat provides cabins for people to travel overnight or over a few weeks. You know that a particular person rented one of the cabins, that the person had money. And you know that the money was stored in the cabin, that's agreed by both parties, and that without negligence of either the boat company or the passenger, the money was stolen. Right? So you know that there's no negligence, you know that there's money that's been stolen from a cabin in a steamboat. More importantly, and that's important for us, you're going to see why, the court agrees that there's no authority on the matter. So there's no legislation, and because it's in the US, there's no precedent on the matter. There's no precedent on particularly on the matter, so there's no law. Or rather, there's no settled law on the matter. The question then is put to why, how should we decide? Should the boat company be held liable or not? So what the company, so what the court does is look around other cases. And one of the cases that comes up is the case of the responsibility of hotel owners. And the common law, both in the US and beyond, it's a settled principle of the common law that there is strict liability in those cases for hotel owners. So if you're not a steamboat owner but a hotel owner, you effectively are going to be held responsible for the money stolen from your guests' room. Right? Even if there's no negligence for either part, or especially if there's no negligence for either part. If the guest is negligent, of course, you're not going to be held liable. But if there's no negligence in either part, that happens. So now you have to argue this. There's no settled law in the matter. Is any other legal resource I can use to try to find a legal decision that's not within the realm of these sources? Well, the court in Adams says, yeah, we can use analogy. And we can use analogy in relation to the source case of the hotel owners. So the source case is the case of the hotel owners. The target case is the case of the steamboat corporations. And what we have to do now is provide an argument that would lead us to conclude that the same solution that was found for hotel owners has to be found as well for steamboat corporations. The argument runs on page 7 like this. First premise, the one that identifies in the source case relevant features, says something like this. A hotel guest procures a room for personal use. His money and personal effects are highly subject to fraud and plunder from the proprietor. So there are features here in hotel owners, yeah? Second premise. The steamboat passenger procures a room for personal use, and his money and personal effects are highly subject to fraud and plunder from the proprietor. So we're seeing that something that applies to hotel owners also applies to steamboat corporations that rent rooms like that. So that's premise 1 and 2 in the scheme, yeah? Features F and G, or features F here, is present in, in the source case, present in the target case. Then we have a further feature. A hotel guest proprietor has a stringent responsibility such that the proprietor is liable without proof of negligence if money is stolen from a guest room. Okay, so we know something else about hotel owners that we don't know about steamboat corporations. We know that in hotel owners, in the hotel owner's case, there is responsibility, strict liability. And remember, it's an assumption of ours that there's no settled law. The court as well, the court said there's no law, settled law in the matter. And then you use the fourth premise, which is the one that identifies the relevance criterion. Something like this. Procuring a room for personal use and having one's money and personal effects highly subject to fraud and plunder from one's proprietor is a reason for the proprietor having such a stringent responsibility. So what you're saying is the fact that your goods are highly subject to plunder, to fraud and plunder from the proprietor, regardless of being a hotel owner or a steamboat corporation, is what justifies, ultimately, the liability, the strict liability. So if that applies to the hotel owner, and we know that it applies to the hotel owner, it should apply as well to the steamboat corporation. And that's the conclusion of the argument. The conclusion of the argument is a steamboat passenger's proprietor, because remember, number 4 talked about proprietors in general, not about hotel owners. A steamboat's proprietor is liable without proof of negligence if money is stolen from the passenger's room. It seems that it solves the problem. Remember, this is just the structure of the argument. It might be that this is a bad argument, but the structure, if Golding is right, that captures the structure of analogy, whether it's a good analogy or a bad analogy, it always has a structure. Always. So if it's something that seems to solve the problem so neatly, so clearly, why do Louise and I have a problem with it? So what's the problem here? We think there are two kinds of problems with this reconstruction. I'll announce them and then I'm going to explain them. I think that the first problem is that if this is the right reconstruction of arguments by analogy, it's not clear that the source case is relevant at all. I'll explain in a bit. It looks like it becomes just argumentatively idle. I'll explain why. The second problem, which I'm going to address in a few minutes, is that the conclusion of an argument by analogy is not a descriptive conclusion. It's a normative conclusion. It tells us of how a case should be decided, right? Not how a case was decided by law, because we don't have settled law. It tells us what we should do. And if you need, if you have a normative conclusion, you need to have a normative premise, yeah? And we think that in this reconstruction, it's not clear. Well, we don't think that there is a normative premise, but I think that Goldie and others, when they talk about this, they confuse matters. Now, that, of course, doesn't apply to analogies like the car salesman, because that's not a normative analogy, it's just a descriptive analogy. It's an analogy about induction, really, that uses, relies on induction. But so the second point, the normative point, really is a problem for lawyers rather than people using knowledge to learn things from the world. The first problem is a problem for everyone, the relevance of the source case, right? So let me go back quickly to the first problem. There's a very simple way to show you what I mean by it, right? If you take the reconstruction I just read to you of the Steamboat Corporation, or the car salesman, it looks like the conclusion follows deductively from 2 and 4. That if you accept the truth of 2 and 4, you are compelled deductively to accept the conclusion. So, if for the argument of analogy to run, you need to accept the truth of all the four premises for the conclusion to be established. And if you only need 2 and 4, what are 1 and 3 doing there? So let me read to you 2, 4, and the conclusion, right? And then we'll see if it doesn't follow logically, deductively. Procuring a room for personal use and having one's money and personal effects highly subject to fraud and plunder from one's proprietor are reasons for the proprietor having such a stringent responsibility. A simple passenger procures a room for personal use, and his money and personal effects are highly subject to fraud and plunder from the proprietor. Conclusion is that a simple passenger's proprietor is liable without proof of negligence. It's really if P then Q, P, Q. So now we have the conclusion of the argument arising from simply two premises. So why do you need the source? So that's one of the problems. Now, I think there is a solution for that. I think there's a solution that doesn't help Goldie in law, but there is a solution for that. But you see the problem. If this is supposed to be a reconstruction of analogy, and you don't need to have the premises, why do you, it's not a reconstruction of analogy. Analogy is supposed to be to give some relevance to the source case. This makes the source case completely dispensable. So if you know that having your goods subject to fraud and plunder is a good reason to hold you liable, and if you know that in the same boat that happens, you don't need the hotel owners. If you already know H, and you know what happens in hotel owners, that's all you need. Source case, premises 1 and 3, the source case becomes idle in the argument. Now, the way some people, Scott Brewer amongst others, have tried to solve this problem is by doing what I think is a radical revision on Goldie's scheme. And it might work up to a point. So what Scott Brewer says is that, forget about analogy. Analogy is a name we use not for one argument, but for two arguments that are often put together. Each argument has its own structure, its own argumentative form, and when you put them together, we have an analogy. Right? So the second argument is the one I just read to you. It's a deduction, modus ponens. If P then Q, P, therefore Q. But of course, for you to get to the point of the premise 4 in our example, so the relevance premise, the premise that says that the features they share is relevant for the features you want to investigate. If you think that that premise can be established on the basis of previous examples, in descriptive context by induction perhaps, or more probably even in descriptive context by abduction. So what you do is that the best explanation, so you know the difference, yeah? Induction relies on an inference that you make in relation to normally probability of something being correct. An abduction is not about probability, it's really about providing the best possible explanation for something. So many scientific theories, they are not reasoned by induction, they're reasoned by abduction. So the reason why apples fall is, and then you get to, I don't know, Newton's relativity or Newton's mechanics or Einstein's relativity. So you get something like the best possible explanation. So it might be that the relationship between 1, 3, and 3 is what gives us 4. So now we don't have one argument, we have two arguments. We have one argument going from the source case to the premise of comparison, of relevance, right? So because hotel owners have this feature, we ask, why do hotel owners have this feature of being strictly liable? Well, the best explanation can only be that hotel owners, they have the keys to the room and they can throw, and the guests are highly subject to fraud and plunder. So if that's the best explanation, that gives us premise 4. And now the argument seems to be actually a two-stage argument. Abduction to premise 4, and then you use premise 4 with the description of the case, and you get. So there is a solution of sorts. I think it's not a good solution in its own terms for many reasons, amongst which I think it gives up too soon on the idea that you can have a unified structure that's peculiar to analogy, doesn't break down into a number of arguments. It gives up too soon. I think there's at least one reconstruction that you can give that's going to give you an integrated account of analogy. Not surprisingly, that's my reconstruction. So I think it's up to soon. But that's not the most important problem. That's the first burden. So whatever reconstruction I give you has to be given in such a way that the source case is not irrelevant. So when you read my reconstruction, you have to test it. And one of the tests you have to use against it is whether the premise that describes the source case is necessary for the argument. If it's not necessary, I fell into the same trouble that Golding fell. Very well. But the second problem, I think, is more difficult to circumvent. And in fact, I think it's impossible to circumvent, so that's why we need another reconstruction, another account of the structure of the argument by analogy. Second problem, if you remember, is that I'm speaking for too long. I've given this paper in different lengths, so I'm afraid this might overrun 45 minutes a bit. So, right. Very well. If you remember, the second problem was that the conclusion is normative, is about how cases should be decided. The way Golding phrases it is you have reasons to do so. It's a weak should. It's not a duty. It's a weak should. It's a should. It's a normative premise. And where are the normative premises? It's a normative conclusion. So where are the normative premises? If you ask Golding, Golding would say that premises 3 and 4 are normative. I'm not sure they are. Or rather, I'm sure that 3 is not normative. I'll run it by you in a minute. 4 is not entirely clear because 4 is ambiguous. It could be read as a descriptive premise or it could be read as a normative premise. If it's read as a descriptive premise, well, it doesn't solve the problem because you cannot derive an ought from an is, so you still have the same problem. But if it's a normative premise, if it's interpreted in such a way that it's a normative premise, and I'm going to explain all that, so I'm just announcing what I'm going to prove. If it's read as a normative premise, it's not clear that it has anything to do with the source case again, that you can infer that normative premise from the descriptive the description of the source case. So in either interpretation of premise 4, which I think is on purpose ambiguous, but in either interpretation, you don't get what you need, the normative conclusion. Or if you get the normative conclusion, then you drop the relevance of the source case. Let me just very quickly run by those two points, right? Premise 3 The most natural way to read premise three is as a description of what the law is in the case, yeah? You're not saying that the law should be like that. You're just saying a hotel guest proprietor has a stringent liability such that the proprietor is liable without proof of negligence if money is stolen from the guest room. The most natural reading of this is that you're saying that that's what the law is, not necessarily that the law should be like that or the case should be decided like that. I'm going to jump a part of the argument here because otherwise we're going to be here till tomorrow morning, but believe me, no, you can question me in the Q&A afterwards. More relevantly, I think, premise four is more complicated. So I'm going to read it again, if you don't mind, and then we'll go. So premise four is this. Procuring a room for personal use and having one's money and personal effects highly subject to fraud and plunder from one's proprietor are reasons for the proprietor having such stringent responsibility. Ah. Now, this could be simply reporting on the reasons that the court had, which are not part of the ratio, because if they were part of the ratio, we wouldn't even be talking about analogy. Yeah? We have precedent. So the reasons that lie behind the ratio of the decision, what the judges probably in the privacy of their own thoughts thought about it. But that's a descriptive account of what happened. And from that, no norms can, or no shoulds can ensue. But you might think that this section here of, that is bit here on our reasons for the proprietors having such a stringent responsibility is not describing what the court thought. It's actually giving you substantive should reasons for action. That's what should happen. But then it's not clear that that can be derived from the fact that in the previous case, the court decided in a particular way. So, because I don't think, well, to cut a long story short, I don't think that we can do normative abductions. I think normative abductions they don't work. So that's the second problem with the argument. If you cannot abduct normatively from premises, the descriptive, of course, then either drop the, or either retain the normativity and drop the source case, or you can retain the source case and then suddenly you cannot make the abduction. So it doesn't work. There's something else that I think is annoying about this reconstruction. So those are the burdens, right? First, before I tell you what's annoying, what else is annoying. So the first burden is I have to, in my reconstruction, or in our reconstruction, Louise's and mine, we have to make the source case a necessary element for the argument. So if you drop the premise about the source case, or the premises, the argument shouldn't run. The second burden is that we have to have a normative premise somewhere. Right? In our case, it's going to be premise number four of our reconstruction. We have to have a normative premise somewhere. If we don't have it, if premise four cannot be unambiguously normative, then we fail. But beyond those two burdens that we're going to try to meet in the next 20 minutes, there's something else that's annoying about the way in which Brewer reconstructs the argument. And Golding would probably agree, because he says, well, I don't like this idea of analogy being two arguments, one going up, one going down. It's one argument. And the reason for that is this, is that it's often the case, from Aristotle, that analogy has been described as a move from particular to particular, or in law, from case to case, or from one particular legislative disposition to another particular legislative disposition. So analogies are often thought of as being more, displaying a more direct connection between cases or between particulars. Yeah? And if you have to do the abduction and then get the general rule and then the deduction, there's something about the directness that's lost. I think our account can account for the directness as well. I think actually that's one of the selling points of our account, that we can actually account for the directness. Very well. Now I set up the criterion which I need to be judged. We might come up with other criteria. But at least two burdens I have to meet. If I can come up with a conclusion that shows how we can move from case to case without having to go to a
a very articulated notion of a general principle. That's a bonus. That's a third thing I can do. It should be good. And that's where the handout comes in handy. That's part two of the paper. So Golding's reconstruction was deceptively simple. It looked very simple, but as it turns out, it was very complicated. And needed loads of refurbishment and change, like the one proposed by Brewer, but, and I think ultimately is not satisfactory. But it looked very simple. First time you read it, I think, yeah, of course, that's actually what I thought. First time I read it, I thought, oh, of course, that's a great, simple way to capture analogy. By contrast, ours is deceptively complex. If you look at this, you lose the will to live very quickly. Because there are loads of terms like general question and symbols. And to be honest, after a few months without looking at it, when I read it again a few weeks ago, I thought, what on earth was I saying here? So I had to remind myself of what makes this very, very simple. So if Golding's was deceptively complex, ours is deceptively simple, ours is deceptively complex. It looks very complex, but if I break down the elements to you, you're hopefully going to see that it's actually quite straightforward. But you know that, but in order to do that, I have to introduce the particular kind of vocabulary and concept that you used here that's not been used so far in this paper. So there are things like comprehensive question, general question, particular question, uniform answer. There are very many aspects of this that we coined to have a particular meaning to be able to capture the argument of analogy. And what I'm going to do in the next 10 minutes is basically to introduce that to you, to introduce the vocabulary. As soon as we have the vocabulary in place, we're going to look at this scheme again, and look at this scheme against the background of the Adams case, the steamboat case, and you're going to see that it's not as difficult as it looks in the first instance. So how did Louise and I decide to do this? That was, we decided to introduce it by telling you a story. And in this story, the different concepts are going to come up in different junctures of the story. That's the story of Amy. For those of you who read the paper, that's the part of the paper that should read very straightforwardly, because it's really a story. So Amy is someone who is faced with a particular question, right? What should the hotel owner X, well, I'll call him Ms. H, yeah? Should Ms. H be held liable for the money, for the £200 stolen from room 158 that belonged to Mr. G? So Amy has to say yes or no. She has to give a definite answer. It's yes or no. Is Mr. H liable or not? And she might be tempted to say, yes, it should. Ms. H should be held liable. But Amy has a friend, a philosopher friend, Barbara. But in the original version of the paper, she was a philosopher. Now she is, I think, just a friend. She has a philosopher friend. The philosopher friend came to her and said, yeah, okay, fine. But let's suppose that Mr. G, the guest, also had a watch stolen next day in the morning at the breakfast table, and he just left it there, and someone stole it. Should Ms. H, the hotel owner, be held liable then? Now, of course, Amy might think that yes, the hotel owners should be responsible for everything in the world, who knows. But our Amy thinks that there's something odd going on here. Amy thinks that there's a difference between the cases. And of course there's a difference between the cases. Yeah? There are many differences. We're talking about watches and breakfast tables. There are infinite differences between the cases. But then Barbara presses the point. She said, okay, fine. So yeah, of course they're different. The cases are different. But what about another hypothetical case in which in another part of town, Mr. O, or Mrs. O, I don't know, Mr. O, the owner of another hotel, also has the unlucky Mr. G as a guest. And again, Mr. G has £200 stolen from him from the hotel room, number 158, in that hotel room. Those cases are different, Amy, Barbara says. And if they're different, of course, you don't think you're committed to saying that they're also liable, strictly liable. Amy might then think, yeah, each case is a case, but normally, the most natural answer for us to give, and I think for Amy to give, is, well, it is a different case, but somehow it isn't. It's different under some descriptions, but not under others. Not under the relevant descriptions. And she might feel tempted then to try to explain how the case raised in question three here is the same as question one in some sense. And in that sense, question two here is not the same as question one. So question one and question two are different questions in a way that question three and question one aren't. Now, they're of course different in the trivial sense that, of course, any two cases are going to be different in some respect. But there's a sense in which they aren't. And then, or Amy might feel tempted to say, well, what's at stake here? She has to universalize. So questions one, two, and three are particular questions, right? They're questions that are particularly bound. Right? They're not expressed in terms of variables, but in terms of constants. Of course, sometimes you use variable words just because it's more natural in natural language. But they're supposed to be particular questions. They are not universalized questions, or general questions. Amy then, in order to explain why one and three are the same and one and two are not the same, she would have to come up with something like four. She would have to say something like this. Really, the question you're asking me in relation to one is an instance of the more general question as to whether hotel owners should be held liable for money stolen. And of course, stolen from their guest rooms without negligence on either part of the guest. I said, well, in the breakfast table, there's negligence by Mr. G, so that's why it's different. In the other case, there's no negligence. But as you can see in question four, there's no reference here to Ms. H or to Mr. O, but to hotel owners. Both of them are hotel owners. So question four is a general question in relation to questions one and three, but not in relation to question two. Well, that's important for us because an answer to question four would imply the same answer to questions one and three, but not imply the same answer to question two. Right? That's the concept of a general question. A general question stands in relation to sub-general questions, sub-questions, in such a way that if an answer is given to a general question, the same answer is implied in relation to whatever sub-question that is. So far, we only talked about particular and general. But you can go up the ladder of abstraction. And in fact, that's what we do in the paper. Because a sub-question is not necessarily a particular question. You can have a particular question as being a sub-question of a general question, but you can have higher level general questions that are going to encompass a number of general sub-questions. Right? You can move up the ladder of abstraction. Let me show you how. Oh, and of course, what the answer to the question is, for Amy, to question four, would be something like rule R. Yeah? The answer is for every X and for every Y, if X is a, so it's general, yeah? Universalizable. Universalized, actually. If X is a hotel owner and Y is a guest and a hotel, and et cetera. Right? So the answer is that rule. Now, Barbara then might bring the Adams case to Amy. I say, oh, okay. What about steamboat corporations that provide accommodation for money to their guests? Now, of course, Amy might say, well, it's entirely different.
But if Amy thinks that there's some sense in which they are not to be distinguished, that they are instances of the same what? Same question. It might be that they're same, that between the two cases, steamboat corporations and hotels, what she might be thinking, and I think that's what the court did in Adams, is that there is a more general question that's not about hotels or steamboats, that is a general question in relation to question four. Yeah. So, as you know, question five here is another particular question, yeah? Should the steamboat corporation X be a problem? And she might come up with a more general question, which would be question six. Should steamboat companies be held liable for money stolen from passengers, etc.? So the functional equivalent to hotel owners. So she might go from particular to general. But if she wants to say that the steamboats and the hotels are somehow the same, what she needs to provide us with is something like in the next page, question seven. She needs to say something like this. Should providers of accommodation be held liable for money stolen? See, notice, it's marked in blue because that's the only relevant bit. All the rest just repeats the... So what she did here is to find a question that's more general than the general question about steamboats in general and the general question about hotel owners in general. This particular question is about providers of accommodation. An answer to this question would imply answers both to hotel owners in general and to steamboat corporations in general. And then, hence, to the sub-questions there, to particular steamboat corporation S, X, and Ms. H. So as you can see, Q7, an answer to Q7, is going to imply an answer to both Q4 and Q6, the general questions about hotels and steamboats, because both are providers of accommodation, yeah. And it would imply also answers to Q1 and Q5. But not an answer to Q2. So you can see that how the relationship between the questions is established. Yeah. Now, I'll cut a longer story short here. And the trouble is, sometimes when you formulate those things, you are more sure that there is a similarity between two cases than we are sure about what the similarity is. Sometimes we can say that there is a general rule that should apply to both hotels owners and steamboat corporations, but we're not entirely sure what the rule is. And in fact, when we provide a formulation of the rule, we might be overshooting the mark. Barbara, who is very, very tiresome, she might come up with something else, another case. In fact, those cases are not randomly selected. This case about the trains that I'm going to mention now is also cited in the Adams decision. Because there was another case of train money being stolen from train berths in which the provider of accommodation was asked, there was a question as to whether or not the provider of accommodation should be held liable. And in that case, the court decided no, that in train berths, be no liability. But forget about the Adams case for the moment. Think about Amy. So Amy's basic intuition is there's nothing really different between hotel owners and steamboat corporations, but there seems to be something weird going on here. There's something I never tracked, I never thought about before. And it was not in my formulation of Q7. When I formulated it, I didn't think about it. But it makes a difference between train berths and hotel rooms and cabins in steamboats. And the difference is that in one case you have exclusive use. In the other case, in berths, you don't. You share a cabin with strangers. Right? You see what happened here? Amy is very convinced that there's something that brings steamboat corporations and hotels together. But she actually, when she formulated it in Q7, she overshoots the point. It's not about simply providers of accommodation. It's about providers of close accommodation. That's what she tries to track in question 9.
So in Question 9, she reimagines her general question. The general question is not really about providers of any accommodation, but only providers of closed accommodation. So you notice what's interesting here is that her basic intuition was there. She decided the case, Timbold case, based on the basic intuition, but when she articulated it, she overshot the target. She made a general question that was much wider than she needed. And in fact, that included train births, for instance, that shouldn't have been included. Right. So we think that now you have the equipment to read the scheme. Do you mind if I read the scheme with you very quickly? And then do that with Adams. So filling the variables here with actual parts of Adams. And then I'm going to just very briefly use 5 minutes to conclude what we think is the upshot of this, right? So let's go through the scheme. GT is the general question that's in the target case, right? GT is a general question that's not authoritatively settled. So the question of whether steamboat corporations should be held liable is not being authoritatively settled. That's what the court says. The court says there's no precedent, there's no source of law that applies directly to this, there's no settled law. Second premise, the source GS is a general question, so it's a general question of the source case, that is authoritatively settled. It's the hotel situation that is authoritatively settled. We have authoritative precedent. In that case, there's not even precedent, I don't think, but authoritative source that gives an answer to that general question. Premise three is where things start becoming interesting. There's a more general question of which GT and GS are sub-questions, and to which there is a uniform answer. Call this more general question GC. Now we know what a sub-question is, yeah? It's a relation of implication. A general question is general in relation to any question, sub-questions. If the answer to the general question implies the answer to the sub-question, right? So there is a more general question of which both GT and GS are sub-questions. Now we have two examples here that have been used by Amy. Question 7, yeah, providers of accommodation. And then when she refines it, providers of closed accommodation. Both of them are general questions. Yeah? Now, why uniform answer? This is a bit distracting, I'm sorry for that, but it's necessary. Because you might think that although they have the same answer, they have the same answer for entirely different reasons. And we have to the analogy only works if they are connected. Yeah? They have to, the answer, the question, the more general question has to have a uniform answer, not a it depends answer. And now premise 4 is our normative premise. For every X and every Y, I'll go very slowly here, okay? If A, X is a general question that is not authoritatively settled, right? Y is a general question that is authoritatively settled, and C, there's a more general question, GC, of which X, both X and Y are sub-questions. So far in the antecedent of the conditional, all we have is 1, 2, and 3, yeah? If 1, 2, and 3, effectively. The consequent then goes, and to which there is a uniform answer, sorry. The consequent then goes, then there is a reason to adopt with regard to X the answer that is implied by the same uniform answer to GC that implies the authoritatively adopted answer to Y. Now, this reason to, so there's a reason to adopt, there's a reason to adopt in relation to the target case the same answer that the general question of which the target is a sub-question gives, right? Now, what's important here is this. Regardless of the source, the ultimate source of this normative premise, this is always going to be present. It might be that you think that there are reasons to adopt it because you espouse predictability in law. You want people to be able to predict law, and that's the best way to do achieve predictability. It might be because you like coherence. I think that's a very strong argument for that. We are agnostic in relation to where the normative strength of this premise comes from, it might be, I think it's an argument by, of coherence, really. But other people may have different views. The argument works regardless of how you prove the truth of this premise. Yeah? We're trying to capture the structure. As I said at the beginning, not all there is to analogy. There are reasons why analogies might be good or bad. And those are legion. I gave two examples, arguments of coherence and arguments about predictability in law. There are probably many, many others. Whatever one you use has to be formulated as you enter the argument like this. Right? And then the rest is very easy, because the rest is really modus ponens. So, as you can see, if from 1, 2, 3, and 4, 4 is the conditional, now, and 1, 2, 3 are the antecedent of the conditional. So, if the conditional is true, and the antecedent of the conditional is present, then 5 follows. And then you just have to add what answer was provided for the source case, strict liability, and then you have the answer to the target case. If you want to see that in terms of how it would look like in Adams, that's very simple. Sorry, I'm taking too long to make this point. That's fine. Oh well, such is life. Sorry. So this is how the argument runs if you're going to reconstruct Adams along those lines. The question whether steamboat premise one. The question whether steamboat companies should be held liable for money stolen from a passenger's cabin without negligence on the part of either the passenger or the company is a general question that's not authoritatively settled. So I just replaced GT by the question that was asked to the court. The general question implied by the particular question asked to the court. Then, second premise. Note, I'm going to replace GS by the description of the hotel owners. The question whether a hotel owner should be held liable for money stolen from a guest room without negligence on the part of either the guest or the hotel, and then go back to the scheme, is a general question that is authoritatively settled. Call it the source case, source question. Then three is exactly the same as in the scheme. Four is exactly the same as in the scheme. Five is exactly the same as in the scheme. The only thing that changes is then six, because then I have the answer, yeah? I need to add the answer. What was the answer in the first case? I haven't mentioned that in the argument yet. Now in six, I have to do that. In terms of six, I would say something like this. The answer that is implied with regard to the target question by the same uniform answer to GC, to the general question, that implies authoritatively adopted answer to source. So far, the same as six. And then the answer is that steamboat companies should be held liable for money stolen from passenger's cabin without negligence. Then there's a reason to adopt that answer. So that's, if we are right, that's what analogies in law are. But there's more. So if we had only achieved that, I think we, and I'm not sure I have, it's for you to judge, it would have been already quite a bit of progress, considering that in the last 25 centuries we've been trying to track this structure and failing. So that's why I'm a bit skeptical about my own argument. I'm convinced by my argument, but it cannot be that we got it now. But all I can do is to put it forward. But if the scheme works, we can do more. And that's more relevant for the common law. The same structure, the same concepts, can be used to explain, I think, what's the difference between following a precedent and distinguishing in common law systems. Can provide an answer for, well, so hence it can provide a concept of distinguishing. And what for me is the most interesting bit, it can meet the 2.5 burdens identified before, the two burdens plus the case to case. So if you look at the argument doesn't run without the source case. The argument simply doesn't run. One of the elements of the antecedent of the conditional is not going to be present. So the source case is essential for the argument. Second, the conclusion is normative, and there is a normative premise. Now, we don't know what the ultimate source of that normative premise is going to be, but there's a normative premise in the reconstruction of the structure of the argument. So we meet the second burden. Moreover, because Amy doesn't need to articulate necessarily, and judges often don't do, what the general question actually is, right? There are policy reasons why they don't do that. In the common law, they tend to stick to the lowest possible level of abstraction because they don't want to invade the authority of Parliament. There are many reasons for you to not to give the actual formulation of the general question you think is there, or you might be wrong about it. The argument runs nevertheless. All you have to admit, all you have to accept, and you can argue about that without declining the full rule that you're arguing about, all you have to accept is that there is a general question that subsumes the two sub-questions and the target and the source. And that's the beauty of it. You can argue about that without formulating the complete rule. You might formulate the complete rule if you like. You might even formulate the wrong rule, but still it's going to be a general question, a more general question, a comprehensive question. Moreover, sometimes you don't need to argue about that. Sometimes the parties agree that there is a similarity. Sometimes it depends on the dynamics of the argument. So you can have this argument working perfectly well without having to come up with a rule that comprehends all possible cases that are going to be analogized in the future in relation to this particular case. You can proceed step by step. You don't need to provide all the positive and negative conditions. So if this is right, we are vindicating also the old Aristotelian idea that you move from particular to particular. You don't need to move up to a complete formulation of the rule like Brewer wants to do, and then apply it to today's case. No completed formulation is needed. That's part of the reason why the questions thing came up, is that you don't need to formulate the rule. You just assume that the answer to the question is going to be the same, and you can argue about that. You can argue about, for instance, steamboat corporations being the same as hotel owners without having to articulate the whole thing. So, there it is. That's the solution for the problem, one of the problems that have been tormenting humanity for many, many centuries. Thank you.